Michelle Thomas, and welcome to the My Shit Therapist podcast. I hope you're well. I am just inching my way back to normality after a two-week break from all media. So I haven't been on any socials. I haven't listened to the news for 2 weeks. I assume that if there were a zombie apocalypse, somebody would let me know. After a year of doom scrolling constantly, when every swipe on my phone meant another spike of adrenaline and it brought more and more awful news about COVID or Brexit or climate change or horrible acts of racist and misogynistic and structural cultural violence. And my anxiety came to a head after the murder of Sarah Everard. And I felt that to be present on social media meant to be constantly confronted by the spectre of sexual violence and male violence. And maybe that's true all the time, but it just felt particularly close to the surface in those days after her murder. And it felt like I was choosing to plug in to a bottomless supply of fear and hostility and outrage and grief and aggression. And I started having awful, violent dreams about women being hurt. And I had one where my cat was choking and I couldn't save her. And then I woke up and spent the morning Googling first aid for cats. Turns out you can just give them the Heimlich manoeuvre, and instead of mouth to mouth, you give them mouth to nose. So I deleted all of the apps from my phone. I stopped sleeping with my phone. I left it in another room overnight to charge, and I started using a radio alarm. This backfired slightly on the first day when I was woken up by a news reporter going, AstraZeneca are saying that we're going to run out of the vaccine by April. That's not wholly true. That was a misleading headline, but it scared me. And I feel so much better now. I've been sleeping better. My concentration's improved. I've spent more time writing and exercising and talking to actual real life friends and family, which has been so nourishing and so good for the soul. And I recommend it. And even if your job relies on your hearing the news and consuming and using social media, if you want to try and cut down, if you think that it's harming you, if you can take steps to be more intentional as you use it, please do so. I believe a time will come when there are recommended, regulated terms of use for social of, say, no more than 5 hours a week. And it'll have warning labels like alcohol, because it is a mind-altering drug. And at the moment, we're just indiscriminately filling our eyeballs with stuff that might over time be causing very real, legitimate harm to our psychological and physiological systems. There are very clever people who have written this down, and I'm not one of them. I've got nothing to back it up but my own anecdotal evidence. I was feeling really breathless. My heart was racing a lot. And after cutting out social media completely for a couple of weeks, it's calmed down a lot. And I feel better. So if you needed a sign to step away from socials, this is it. Okay. So today I am talking to the brilliant and incisive and wise Nell Frizzell. She is the author of the book The Panic Years, which explores the tumultuous period that women and men experience, although differently, between their late 20s and their early 40s, when they're faced with these huge, weighty, life-changing decisions about parenthood and career stuff and relationships and all that juicy, impactful stuff. She also hosts a podcast of the same name, which I love. The Rob Delaney episode in particular is just gorgeous. I particularly enjoyed hearing him talk about struggling to find trousers that can accommodate his outsized buttocks and thighs, but that might just be me. So Nell has been in therapy for about 9 years, and we fell into talking about how we can examine our relationship with our fathers and how that's perceived in women and in men, which is why I've called this episode Daddy Issues. I hope you like it. Are you ready? Okay, let's go. I've only got one question that I ask people, and that is, what is the best and worst thing a therapist has ever said to you?
Oh, I've got the worst. So I was seeing a woman therapist, and I think that's the only time that happened in my life. I normally, and at the moment, see men, because I think I have quite a lot of the, how can I put this? So a lot of my life is surrounded by the voices of women, and I feel like I can get that quite easily, and I can get a sort of female perspective. But what I don't have much of is the voice of a kind of a man, and possibly a man that I'm enabled to look up to or project onto safely. So I've always currently have a male therapist, because I find it very helpful to have that kind of, it's like that's the missing in the sort of circle of my psyche, that's like the little bit that's maybe less well supported than everything else. But I did briefly, when I was still living in London, have a female therapist it just was not a good mix. And I know now enough about therapy to know that I should have just said, I think our dynamic's wrong. And she's probably a very good therapist for a different person, but she was just the wrong therapist for me at the time. So I stuck with it. And it was when I was breaking up with, unbeknownst to me, my partner at the time, who's the person that I break up with at the beginning of my book. And I remember saying to her that I just didn't feel, I mean, all the classic things that will be familiar to anyone who's ever sort of towards the end of their 20s, when they have about to embark on quite a major life change and are coming to the end of a relationship, all of these things will be familiar. I said that I was feeling, I just didn't feel very fun or very sexy. I wasn't feeling kind of vibrant in my relationship. I felt like we had sort of grown into quite a sort of static, heavy kind of cohabitation that didn't necessarily feel like the love that it had been, and that I wasn't sure what I wanted and who I really was anymore. And she said, well, sometimes I like to just put on a pair of boots that make me feel really sexy, and put on makeup and go out and have a laugh. What the fuck is that? Like, what is that? Not like, and maybe before and subsequently she did do a bit more digging into that. But I remember the time thinking, this isn't therapy. This is loose women. Like, this is daytime telly. What on earth is this about? And, you know, anyway, that was that experience of therapy, which ended in a sort of fairly unfulfilling way and all of that. And I think the best thing a therapist has ever said to me, and it sort of goes back to the why I am drawn to particular kinds of therapists, is something that keeps coming up and keeps coming up, is that I am worried that if I'm not interesting enough or working hard enough or appreciative enough, or if I show a part of me that feels too vulnerable or too unattractive or too weak or unpleasant, sort of, you know, naked raw, that my therapist will not necessarily reject me and leave, although that is a fear I have, but that my therapist will even just to himself think, oh God, I'm so sick of this woman. So, which we've talked about because he's brilliant and we can talk about this. And I, you know, it's the sort of thing that crops up fairly regularly that I'm worried that I am somehow going to disappoint him or underwhelm him or frustrate him or irritate him. And one day, in the course of a sort of slightly longer speech, and, you know, I have psychoanalysis, so he barely speaks at all. He did say something like, you know, because you are my client and we are in this relationship and I care about you. And it was like, oh my God. And he, you know, what he means is he's in a position of care. Like that's what to be a therapist is. It's not, he was by no means crossing that kind of magical silver line between a personal relationship and a professional relationship as a therapist. I know nothing about him. I know nothing about him. And we have like this incredible relationship because he is such a mystery to me. I can project all of this stuff onto him and then I can work through it all and it's great. But I do remember just for a second thinking, oh my God, he is looking after me and he does care about me. And it was like a, you know, just occasionally without meaning to, you'll like click, it feels like you've clicked your breastbone back into place or your like neck suddenly goes straight or your ankle clicks back in place or your knee or hip or something just aligns again. And I can liken it to that feeling. It was like in my heart, something aligned. And for a little bit, and that's the other thing, it's never permanent, but for a little while, I had that feeling of, aha, I've all clicked into place and everything is sort of held in balance and functioning. And it was lovely. And I'm, you know, I've been seeing him now for 8 years. And he's probably in that time, if he said it all together, spoken for maybe 45 minutes. That's maybe an exaggeration, but you know, there's not much, all the talking is very one-sided, as this recording will probably show. But yeah, they're probably the best things and the worst things. And someone said something, I think it was Sarah Pascoe, said something really interesting the other day in an interview I was listening to where she said, a therapist is not cleverer than you. They're not better than you. They don't know anything you don't know. All they do is allow you to sort of view or reframe or come to the conclusions that you're unable to on your own. And I thought that was really interesting that you, your therapist doesn't know stuff that you don't know. They're not necessarily more well-informed or educated or intelligent, although they might be. All they're doing is allowing you to realize the things that you can't realize on your own. So what I'm saying is, it was very nice of him to say that, but I knew it anyway. And then I put on a pair of boots and I went out.
And you felt really sexy.
And I felt really sexy. And
then you just tried having a laugh. And it all worked out.
It's nuts, isn't it? And I used to joke about this, that, you know, there was a little bit of, I sometimes think if denial works, like if you can keep denial up for 70, 80 years, like I think my grandmother did, like my grandmother had such an unbelievable force of will that she just kept up a sort of carapace of coping until she died in her 90s. And I think if it's that good, then keep going, like go for it. That's fine. And so when someone like her of her generation says, oh, buck up, I think fair deal. Like you have bucked up now for like 85 years and it's kept you alive. So fine. But to say that to a woman in her 20s who's clearly unbuckable, it achieves nothing. It achieves nothing.
Exactly. What made you choose psychotherapy or psychoanalysis?
A few things. I think, I'm sure this, well, I've heard this get said on your podcast a lot, but as a writer, I sort of feel like you have a, not a responsibility, because that makes it sound like I'm saying this is a privilege that everyone should really invest in. Of course it's not. But I think the way you, the stories that you tell about your life are incredibly important if you are a writer who is going to write about your life for general public consumption. And so much of psychoanalysis is going into the deeper, older, longer story of who you are and who, what you tell yourself about who you are and how you behave. And CBT and other forms of therapy, I think, are incredible if you need to achieve a certain goal or overcome a specific challenge or navigate some particular trauma or issue for you. But I think what chimed with me as someone who obviously operates on the level of narrative was the idea of digging back and stripping back that narrative and then sort of changing the story I told myself. And I kind of think it's so, you know, so much of psychoanalysis is about listening and language and interpretation and perspective and dialogue and logic and thought. And they're all the things that I'm best, not best at. That's the language that I am most comfortable with. You know, I'm an English graduate and I'm from quite a, you know, storytelling wordy family. And I'm probably more comfortable doing that than I would be other forms of therapy, because it's how I operate in the world. You know, if I was to try and understand how to change the brake pads on my bike, I am more likely to do that if someone tells me the story of how they're changing the brake pads on their bike, rather than if I look at a diagram of how to change the brake pads on my bike. And so I think psychoanalysis is almost like the storytelling manual for your brain, which is one answer. The second answer is that I was living in London and I was 28 and I was obviously struggling, and I didn't, London is full of people and therapists and, you know, potential. And what you sometimes need is just someone to, you know, it's like you, sometimes rather than an entire menu, you just need someone to make you cheese on toast. And so I wanted the fewer choices. And a brilliant woman that I knew through work, I knew that her parents were psychoanalysts. And I said to her, could, you know, do they know anyone that might be quite good? And I think that's fine. I think that professionally, sort of word of mouth recommendations, because I'd never met these people, the person they recommended I'd never met. And then we had like a formal first session where we were sort of introduced to each other and I told him why I wanted to have therapy and stuff. So it was all done in a kind of above board way. But the fact that it was kind of recommended to me by someone, and she never, obviously, because she is the child of psychoanalysts, never asked me about how it was going, or, you know, like that was just left to me to do. But it happened to be that he was all the things that at that time I needed, because at the time, like I say, I was, had recently come out of a relationship with an older man. I was not really talking to my dad. I was having, like, I was sort of desperately trying to make unsuitable men fall in love with me. Like, I had a lot of issues around the approval and affection of men. And so to have this older, remote, emotionally unavailable, but sort of psychologically completely available man who was, you know, who was articulate and insightful and analytical enough to help me unpack all of the things that I was wrestling with in front of him and to him and at him and about him was really, really good. So I'm very grateful to that woman for doing it. Honestly, it's like, how do you find... I don't know how anyone, listen, I don't know, you've lived in London, haven't you? Like, I sometimes think, how does anyone choose what pub to have their birthday in London? Like, it's fucking, you could choose one of like 1,000 pubs. Mm. How do you choose one? You basically have to do a weird sort of mishmash of, can you walk home from there? And, you know, is it near enough some people? And have you, do you know someone who knows someone who used to have a bar job there? And I kind of think therapy was a little bit like that. It was like my birthday pub venue where I had to just go for the kind of a recommendation by someone I knew and then to scope out that it made sense for me.
Well, I didn't know anyone who
had therapy or was getting therapy when I you know, wanted to start doing it. So I just went by Google Images.
And oh, wow.
And it didn't work out, because in the end I did end up getting a recommendation, but I came really, really close to going with this woman purely because she had a very, very severe bob. Like, a bit like Isabella Rossellini in Death Becomes Her. Just this very sharp, no bullshit, black, no feathers, no texture, no colour.
Yeah.
No, nothing. Just a very severe haircut. And I just thought, she's going to sort me out.
That's like the Donna Tartt of therapists. I want that. I want that, like, Lego black and white
Lego
woman.
Head. Yeah.
That's interesting, because I think we are sort of told not to go by those signals, but they are actually really important, and that's how our brains work. When I was pregnant and, like, my placenta was crapping out on one side and I was sort of having to decide, well, I was debating with my sort of, you know, midwives and people about how I could give birth, and I was referred to this consultant, and I remember walking into the room and she looks like Caroline Lucas. She had, like, very short hair, and she was wearing, like, a beautiful but, like, timeless shirt and, like, plastic jewelry. And I remember thinking, oh, yes, please. Like, yes, please, I want to talk to you about birth. You're just, like, she was the kind of she's an archetype that I had friends' mums who were like that. And I had, you know, a couple of love teachers and my mum's friends and people like that. And I sort of instantly felt like this woman could have told me to do almost anything. And I would think, yeah, okay, I'll go with you. So, of course, you can't make all your decisions based on a haircut. But if a haircut gives you a certain sense of whatever, you know, calm or openness or acceptance, then that's a good thing to go on. It's like smell or, you know, anything else. It's a good signifier, if nothing else.
It was the precision of it. It's something that takes...
And you're also quite a curly haired woman, aren't you?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that. Like, hair wise, she was like my polar opposite.
Ordered. I'm only saying that because I've got a very curly haired friend who jokes, but her house is full of squares. Like, she has gingham curtains. And I think at one point she even had square plates, and she cuts her nails off square, and she, like, wears square pattern things. And she used to joke that she was sort of fighting the innate curliness of her life by being surrounded by squares.
Like the anti-Gaudi.
Yeah. Or who's the Japanese artist that does spots everywhere?
Marimekko.
Thank you.
And I know that because she's just done a collaboration with Uniqlo, and I've just bought a dress in the sale for a
Nice.
So something that just sprang to mind, and I am going to say it, and I really hope that you don't take offense or that you don't want to talk about it. But the thing that came to mind was when you mentioned about your dad and about the unsuitable relationships you were in, the thing that popped into my head, and it's not a judgment, it was like, oh yeah, daddy issues. And it wasn't, it not in a judgment, but it just that's the shorthand that we have for, and we don't have a shorthand for mummy issues, and we don't apply that to men, as though men don't have fathers.
Well I
find that really interesting.
You're a very good interviewer, because I've just written, and I think I'm allowed to talk about this, but I'm in the process of writing, I'm on, like, the third draft of my first novel, which has the working title Daddy Issues, for precisely the reason that I think it's a really underexplored relationship, because we have this short term, like this shorthand that basically, like a fire blanket, gets thrown over, like, so many interesting, complicated feelings, situations, occurrences. But we just say, daddy issues, don't have to talk about that anymore. Whereas I think when women talk about their relationships with their mothers, we get really granular into that because we don't have the same shorthand. Or when men talk about their relationships with their fathers, we don't have that. And so I think it is a really underexplored thing. And I find it fascinating because, as I write in the novel, there's, I think, from, you know, in my life and so many friends around me, the existence of sex complicates that relationship on both sides from like a very particular point. And it's at times awful and at times hilarious and at times incredibly constructive and at sometimes incredibly destructive. So I have, for example, been mistaken for my dad's girlfriend, which is like a Freudian nightmare, you know, at like parties and stuff. And I've also my dad will like occasionally, if my son goes to stay with him, like have a bath with my son. And then there's this moment of like, I can't really walk in the bathroom when he's having a bath with my son. But like if my son, you know, all of that stuff, or like if I had an accident, would I get my dad to come and like wipe my bum? Or is that too, you know, there's so, and then like, I have also had like weird flirtatious moments with my dad's friends. And then I've had my friends tell me that my dad is good looking, and that like there's a myriad of weird things. And then I've also slept with lots of older men, and I've also like tried to, in positions of work or non-romantic situations, been drawn to older men who can kind of make me feel safe and protected and all of that stuff. So there's, it's a really complicated thing. And I think it's sometimes talked about, you know, we have like the Oedipal complex and there is the Hydra complex, but the, what that looks like in the modern world from the sort of, you know, politically engaged, emotionally engaged family like mine, I think doesn't get much airtime. And it's often hilarious. Like it's often very funny. When my dad, he had a hernia operation, and it was during lockdown, so no one else could go into the house. But he'd come home from hospital, and I got a phone call saying that he was very worried, something very bad was happening. And I was like, oh, Jesus, what is it? So I turned up, and we had at that point bubbled up so I could go into his house. And I went, and he was sort of very ashen-faced and sort of jittery and weird. And he said, my willy's gone purple and it's really lumpy and weird. And I was like, oh, for fuck's sake. And my dad has a girlfriend. And I was like, why is your girlfriend not the one to do this? Like, why does it have to be me? And he also has two younger daughters, like they're younger than me. And I was like, well, definitely don't want them to have to deal with this. So like, at least it's me. So I was caught between this sort of like, why is it me? And also, well, at least it's me. And he was like, do you want to see it? And I was like, absolutely not. I mean, never in my life do I ever want to see this. But I could see that he was getting increasingly anxious about it. And he was saying, I don't, you know, he'd keep like shuffling off to the toilet and then like going, oh, I don't know if it's getting better or worse. And I said, well, you could try taking a photo of it and then you'll at least have a record of whether it's getting worse or better. And so he like shuffled off, and he'd, you know, he just had major surgery. So he was like in a lot of, I imagine, discomfort and fairly immobile. But he was like, oh, after a few minutes, if I could hear this sort of shuffling and it's not gonna, I can't do it. It's really hard to take a photo, which I've never taken a dick pic and actually never received one. But I imagine the angles are complicated, particularly after heavy surgery. So he asked, he was like, it's just a willy. I'm your dad. Can you take a photo of it? And I was like, I mean, yeah, I can now. And if this were my mum and she said like, something has happened to my breasts or like something has happened to my vulva, I'd be like, yeah, of course I'll come and help. And if I'm going to aspire for equality in my own parenting, then I should probably aspire to equality in my parents, right? Fine, I'll do it. My God, it was the ugliest thing I've ever seen in my life. Like a huge shock of white pubes. And then this very mottled, peculiar penis. Anyway, we found out later that this is this is not unheard of, that if you have a hernia operation, sometimes there is bruising in your groin area. And what bruising on a penis looks like is an insane aubergine dick on a 65-year-old man or whatever. So that's not in the novel because it's too ridiculous, right? It's too insane. But in my podcast, I told this story to Sarah Pascoe, and she said something really nice because she was also estranged from her dad. She said, well, I think that's a sort of, it's a very ugly form of love, but it is love, you know, that you can, he can rely on you and be, you can be intimate with each other like that, and you can help him out, and he can sort of be vulnerable around you. And, you know, a generation ago, that would not have happened. And at least now that we kind of can, you know, be, and also 10 years ago, absolutely would not have happened, you know, or maybe 20, when I was in my early 20s, I barely even spoke to my dad, let alone the idea of being the person he calls in a medical emergency. So that does show a sort of change, you know, something significant has shifted between the two of us. And I can go into all of why that changed and why my relationship with men changed and how I got to a situation where I was able to meet someone who would become the father of my child and who I'm in love with and live with. If you want to hear that stuff.
Of course.
Okay. So there were a few things that sort of helped not solve my daddy issues. But I think if I was to tell the story of the daddy issues, one of the sort of fun things that I found helpful and other people may find helpful was I went to the place where my dad grew up. And unfortunately for me, that means New Zealand. So it was really bloody far away. But I went and I met his family as an adult who I didn't know. And they told me the sort of origin story of my father, which I didn't really know, because with your parents, you don't really, you know, you maybe get a very subjective version from them, which is maybe incomplete and maybe it's the memories of a child. So they're, mm-hmm. you know, not necessarily too insightful. But he has a brother who's 15 years older than him because they were such a big family. And so he can really remember quite a lot about how my dad grew up. And so I met all of these Frizzells who were lovely, all of them, just lovely people who were had like enough of me in them to have like a really profound effect on the way I saw that side of myself. You know, like the Frizzell side of me, I'd always been a bit ambivalent or ambiguous or even a bit sort of resentful towards or rejective of towards. But to meet these people who had like my dad's eyebrows and my shoulders and, you know, laughed at the same jokes and be like, oh, I guess I get that from him. And I suppose that's okay. And I'm quite glad to have that in my life. So I suppose I am maybe more open to a relationship with him than I thought. And then just to paint you a very cinematic picture, I went back to the street that he lived on as a child. And they had a house on the corner, which has now been knocked down, so it doesn't exist. But the street, my dad like came to Britain as like a hippie in the 70s and he'd been through all these like enormous, dramatic, scandalous things on the way here. And he looked like a kind of insane bushman and he's got loads of tattoos and piercings and had lost teeth and was like kind of wild. And, he, you know, he was the kind of guy who would climb trees and go to festivals and be incredibly hedonistic. And he was like the fun uncle-y kind of dad. And I went to this town called Hastings, New Zealand. And I went to Sylvan Road where I had grown up with. And it was honestly the quietest, most boring suburban street I've ever seen in my life. And it was like being in, it was like being in wallpaper paste. It was so quiet and like thick and heavy and boring. It was a really boring town. And I suddenly thought, oh my God, he came from here and he's done all of this with his life. And he sought out adventure and romance and like a European sense of history and culture and ethnicity. And he, you know, he has been drawn, like he is obsessed with world music, and he raised like four daughters and has been very, you know, he wanted to be a really hands-on dad, and he never balked at like the female experience and all its visceral kind of glory. And he was brought up by like a roast dinner every night, like housewife, dad, engineer, you know, would never hugged him kind of family. And I thought, okay, like I do need to give, it was like I had the story, I could suddenly tell myself a story of my dad that made me want to engage with him in a more sympathetic or kind or affectionate way. So that was really important. And obviously that's not available to everybody, because a lot of people, either they don't know their dad, or the place where they grew up is not so significant as it was for me. But for me, it really did have a kind of shift. And I came back to England thinking, okay, so it's on me now to like build a relationship with this man and take him exactly as he is, and not spend my whole life sort of resenting the fact that he's not a, like in my dream father would wear like corduroy trousers and be incredibly well read and very polite and probably like British and sound like me, and you know, would have a hobby, like a garden. He would plant trees, and he would be able to quote bits of poetry, and he would not really talk about sex, and he wouldn't really he would have like funny stories, but they wouldn't be like my dick turned purple stories. But the truth is that those men are in my life. Like I've met those men. They're my friends' dads, and they've been my teachers or my professors or whatever. My dad is he's a different energy at the table. And I either go with that and accept it and sort of value it for what it is, or I lose the potential of that in me. You know, like that's half of who I am. And I, you know, if I reject that, then I reject something fairly fundamental to me and my upbringing and my biology and everything. So that was really significant. And I was in therapy, and I had to sort of work through the, you know, if you have a very fun dad, there is a feeling that you have to perform for affection all the time. You know, like if everything is a celebration of your performance, and you're sort of performing, because if you just lay yourself bare and show your vulnerability, everyone will walk away, like the audience leave, and no one wants to see that. So I had to kind of confront that and do really weird things. Like when I was dating, if a man hurt me or disappointed me, the natural obvious thing would be to phone my mum or one of my female friends, and they would give me incredibly thoughtful, kind, useful advice. The weirder thing that I had to start doing was to phone my dad, who would have sort of weird, clunky, very scant advice that was all strangely incredibly useful, because it had a different energy. It came from a man. It was someone that I didn't normally look for. You know, I remember him saying, this is in the book, I remember saying, God, I'm going to turn 30 soon, and I just am worried that I don't have a partner. I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to have a baby. I don't have a proper job. I certainly can't afford a house, or, you know, I can't drive, blah, 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 blah. Like I haven't got any of these signifiers of being old, and I'm about to turn 30. And what if I'd said that to my mum or my auntie or my friends? They would have all said, but you're wonderful and you can do all these things and you're so kind. And what my dad said was, But this is only because we have a decimal numerical system where we count in tens. If we had a number, if we had a counting system based in eights, you would have had this at 32. Or, you know, and if we counted in sevens, you would have had it at 28. It's just because we count in tens, which is like such a brilliant way of reframing that crisis.
That's a brilliant way of looking at it.
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it? And it doesn't, it's not telling me, it's not in any way reassuring to me personally, and it's not complimenting me, but it's just saying, I'm going to, like, let's just unpack this thinking from a very quote-unquote male rational point of view, which was exactly what I couldn't do for myself, and it was really helpful. And he also said another thing. This is my other, I think my dad's literally given me two useful bits of advice, and my poor mum, because I don't remember any of her advice because there's so much of it, but his, because there's only two I can remember. The other thing he said was, the problem with compromise is nobody's getting what they want.
That's great.
And I remember thinking, at the time, it was when I was like, you know, couldn't meet anyone, or I would try to meet people and it wouldn't be working. And what was happening was I was like compromising the very essence of who I was to try and make people love me. And quite rightly, that doesn't work. Whereas if you can just, one of the most unhelpful phrases in the entire world, just be yourself. But if you can be boldly and brutally true to your sort of innate nature, then people either opt in or they opt out. No one's having to compromise there. Like, they're either fully in or they're off. And if they're fully in and they're in, and like hopefully they're in for a while, which is the relationship that I'm in at the moment. Like, I think I basically gave him the whole shooting match from day one, and he's opted in. And because I've not compromised that, I don't have to worry that there is a sort of shaky, sandy foundation to our relationship. I know that our relationship is based on something pretty solid. So again, like, apparently an insane piece of advice from my dad that has proved really useful.
That is really useful.
I mean, it's not like, it's not a great lesson to teach a child that like compromise is pointless because no one's happy, but but I think when you're in your sort of late 20s, early 30s, it can be useful to be reminded that you don't have to compromise everything in order to get a sort of simulacrum of happiness.
Excellent use of the word simulacrum there. I think that's a podcast.
Sometimes word. I block on words and I can only think of those ones. I forget words all the time, as everybody does. But if you have a big enough vocabulary, rather than just going, oh, what's that word, that you have like an insane version of the word that you can sometimes pull out. Like when I was saying aggressive, I was thinking, what do I, like rebarbative, which does mean the same thing, but no one uses that word. No one's used that word for like 200 years, but I've got it in there from crosswords and stuff. I can pull it out when I need to.
Rebarbative.
Rebarbative, meaning literally to push away. Barb, coming from beard, the like the barbed one. Anyway.
No, I love it. What was it like coming home from New Zealand? What was the first meeting or the first conversation with your dad like after that? And was it this instant, you look at him in a completely different way?
No.
And maybe, you know, this music and... And you put your hand on his shoulder and you say, Dad. And he like tries to like bluff you away and like, oh, yeah, go off with you. And you're like, no, Dad.
Yeah.
And
so my dad was out. My dad was helpfully played by Harrison Ford. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing was scored by Ennio Morricone. And it just worked great. No, what happened? Nothing like that, really. But, and I can't actually tell you what happened the first time I saw him when I came back. But I can tell you that quite the summer after I got back, or that summer I came back, so only a matter of weeks after, I found myself on the roof of his house, helping him to rebuild. He had a flat roof and he wanted to make it a pitch roof, and which is what we would call a slanted roof. And so I, in the spirit of like, I will meet you on your terms and accept you for who you are. So how do I have a relationship with my dad? I go and build a roof with him. So I found myself on a roof wearing one of his old t-shirts from a builder's yard, like a builder's merchant, and hammering these slates into battens. And he would like come over and say, this one's 1 mil out. And I'd say, so? And he'd say, no, but if you do this one mil out, then by the time we get four slates down, they're going to be like 4 or 5 mil out, and then the rain will get in the gaps. And I was like, this is an antithesis to everything I believe in, which is just bodge it and hope for the best. Like, I can't believe you're going to make me redo these things that I've done wrong, because that's not how I fly. But I did. And so we had this sort of strange day where we were up on a roof together listening to local radio. And this is also the kind of thing that you can't put in a book because everyone thinks it's insane. But there was like a Father's Day date my dad phone in on the local radio station. And I remember like saying, like mentioning it to him as a joke, but because he's quite deaf, he thought I was like genuinely proposing that someone on the radio wanted to go out with him. And so we had the sort of day where we were not really talking about anything particularly significant in the way that you would expect it, like sitting down eye to eye, sort of tears. But we would, you know, we would sort of alongside each other, occupied with a task, and would occasionally, you know, I would mention a place that I'd been to in New Zealand, and he would tell me like a story of when he, you know, tried to go down that mountain in a car that didn't have proper brakes, so you had to put on the handle brake and all of that stuff. And then I had a really significant emotional interaction with his workmate. Do you know what a workmate is? It's like it's basically two bits of wood that you winch.
Like a vice.
Yeah, exactly, like a vice. And you can, if you bring the two bits of wood together, and then you can clamp anything in between and then saw it off. Mm-hmm. And I remember looking down in his garden because he was sawing some roof battens, and it was genuinely the workmate that he had when I was a child. So it was at this point, maybe 25, 30 years old. And it was like, it was suddenly like having an uncle in the garden. I was like, oh my God, I remember this. And he told me about how when he'd first moved to London and he couldn't get work, so he ended up being a builder's labourer for this lovely guy called Eddie, and how he had sort of taught him how to build houses. And I sort of had this picture of my dad in his mid-20s as an immigrant in London doing manual labour. And, you know, he is a builder. That's his job. But I was like, oh, my God, you were once my age and you were once as lost as me, and only 2 years after that I was born, and I'm now older than you were when you had me, and I'm wondering if I'm ever going to have a child. And so through almost no speech, I was slowly processing all of these things that I'd been, you know, talking about with a therapist and had come up and now make up the sort of lion's share of my book. And so I think sometimes those, God knows how other people interact with their dads, but I think sometimes it doesn't look the way that conversation would go with your mum, or maybe even your own child or your friend. It's a different way of interacting, and that's conditioning. I know that gender is a social construct, but my generation of parents were constructed with those gender stereotypes. So that's what they are. And, you know, hopefully my son will be a little bit more fluid, and he won't only be able to interact with people through the medium of building. But that's what I had.
That's so interesting. I love that. Thank you. And I'm so glad I asked you that question, because it popped into my head and I thought, oh, that's horrible and really judgmental. But I didn't.
No, I'll tell you what's horrible and judgmental, I think, is when, do you remember, like when a comedian, and I'm not criticizing the guy, but I remember Marc Maron used to have like a bit of material about how he always has a sinking feeling when his girlfriend says that she wants to improve her relationship with her dad because it means they're going to break up soon. And I was just like, that's like daddy issues is a joke that you can, like, you're then able to sort of have sex with young, vulnerable women who haven't sorted out their emotional sort of relationship with their dad. Like, that's gross. And people dismissively saying, oh, daddy issues, when you like get together with an older person. Like, that's unfortunate. But I think as an actual phenomenon to explore, it's really interesting and really textured, complicated, sometimes funny, sometimes revolting area that I think, because we're all so cautious about talking about sexuality, and we're so cautious about talking about, we don't want to fall into the cliche of defining ourselves entirely by our parents, because that's like a kind of Freudian punchline, isn't it? That we don't really want to go into it too much, but I think there is loads there that's worth going into, or was for me anyway.
You can follow Nell on Twitter at Nell Frizzell. The Panic Years is widely available in all of your favourite places. I would recommend it. As ever, you can get in touch with me by emailing myshittherapist@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, take care and take your meds.